This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the OSHAWISE. I'm Natalie Marshall. I'm the chair of this public education series, Lifestyle Strategies to Support Health and Well-Being. Tonight's class is titled Mind-Body Medicine to Build Stress Resilience, and it is my pleasure to introduce your instructor, Dr. Kavita Mishra. Dr. Mishra is an internationally renowned radiation cancer expert and professor in the Department of Radiation Oncology and clinical director of the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine at UCSF. Dr. Mishra earned her undergraduate degree at Harvard University, her medical degrees from UCSF, and her master's in public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. She completed her radiation oncology residency in 2008 at UCSF and thereafter joined the faculty. Welcome, Dr. Mishra.
Hi, Dr. Marshall. Thanks for the intro. Today, we have a few things that I want to discuss with you. It's going to be fast. We have about an hour and then about half an hour for Q&A. And so I love this cartoon, which says, "What's the meaning of life? But make it quick. I've got an important meeting in half an hour." So we'll try to get through as much material as we can today. So today we're going to define what stress and stress resilience is. We're going to explore the relationship between chronic stress, health, and the mind-body connection. And we're going to identify mind-body medicine practices, pearls, and what I like to call mind-body medicine snacks. I think Dr. Marshall mentioned exercise snacks, just like nutrition snacks. Little bits that we can start to bring into our day. So we're going to have a couple of polls throughout. First poll, is stress a good or bad thing? And we'll see what comes across. Okay, it's about half and half, 52-48, 50-50. Okay, perfect. So let's see, about half the group is saying stress is a good thing. Half the group is saying stress is a bad thing. Wow, if this was a test, we would do really bad as a community. I'm going to end the poll. And I'm going to share the results so that you can see them. About 54, 46, about 50-50. And that's appropriate that you all said that, because stress is actually... there's a lot of different definitions of stress. So I'm going to share one definition, which actually shows it to be both a good and a bad thing. That was a trick question to start off with, to increase your stress. So stress is, at least by this definition, a natural human reaction to sometimes everyday and sometimes very intense life pressures. Our bodies are actually equipped to handle stress in small doses. We were built for that. But when stress becomes long-term or chronic, that's when it starts to have really serious impact on our bodies and minds. And so we see this, I probably don't have to tell most of you this, but stress affects the body, the kind of how we think about, quote, stress in many definitions. When it affects the body, it can affect the brain, cardiovascular system, joints, muscles, the immune system, the skin, the gut, the reproductive system. And you see some of the descriptions of what can happen under stress. And if you just reflect for a second of how do you experience stress in the way that, you know, many times we use the word, how do you experience it? Now, why does stress affect the body? Again, we're going to talk about sort of the distress part of stress versus the eustress part of stress. Eustress is stress that we are meant to be able to tolerate and handle and can actually be a good thing for us. Distress is when our bodies are affected and it's not so healthy for us. So why does that happen? Charlie Brown asks. Well, there's a lot of different hypotheses. One major hypothesis is we live in a balance in our system between the parasympathetics and the sympathetics. And the parasympathetics generally is a part of the nervous system, the autonomic system that deals with what we call rest and digest. It's what helps us get into that more restful state. The sympathetics is what we call fight or flight, and they've added some other Fs like freeze. And that's what happens when we're under a stressor where we have to act fast to deal with that stressor. And so the sympathetic activity dominates. And so you can conceptualize that, hey, when we were walking around thousands of years ago in a forest and we come across a tiger, we need to be able to swap into sympathetics and run fast or get away from that tiger. But that was an acute stress, not chronic long-term. So our bodies are meant to pass between parasympathetic and sympathetic balance. However, when we start to get into this feeling of chronic stress, long-term stress, low level, but always stress, and that can be for so many reasons today. It can be for financial reasons, health reasons, political reasons, climate reasons. There's so much going on. And so the theory is that we may be going into something called sympathetic overdrive, or the balance is off. And you can see the long list on the right side of things that can be affected when we're in this out of state balance. And it's a little bit like being in a race car, which my 18-year-old would love to be in, but being in a race car and always having the accelerator down, never kind of braking and making that turn a little bit more peacefully and safely. There are other hypotheses related and extending from that parasympathetic-sympathetic imbalance that we can get into with chronic stress. And something that's really fascinating is the gut-brain axis. And you'll hear more about this in one of the next lectures in terms of the microbiome and what's happening in our gut and how that might be affecting other parts of our body. And so this is just a picturization of stress, which is here shown in the red circle, and what it can do to our HPA axis, hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, which gets triggered in the brain through various hormonal exchanges and ends up affecting the body through the adrenal glands and our immune system, such that it can affect our gut lining, these little cells here that look like the evil guys in Pac-Man. That gut lining is potentially affected by those hormonal shifts, and also our immune system, which would usually catch metabolites or things that are coming across and be able to protect the rest of our body. That immune system is affected so that we're not able to actually protect the body as well. And so that then can lead to symptoms in this picturization of depression, for example, or other inflammatory diseases, and linked to symptoms that you may experience. And so the gut-brain axis is a really interesting area of research today. And so the old saying that your mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother probably told you is that we are what we eat, and that is true. This is a really neat cartoon from the New York Times showing that we live with microorganisms, literally trillions of microorganisms on us, in us, in our gut lining. And we live in what we try to make a symbiotic relationship. However, if that goes awry with stress and or what we are putting into our body nutrition-wise, then that can lead to chronic inflammation and chronic disease. We will talk about that more with one of my colleagues next time. And so this is a great description of the causes and consequences of low-grade systemic chronic inflammation, that SCI in the middle here, in the middle lever. So one of the many things that can lead to chronic inflammation is chronic stress, along with diet, obesity, physical activity, chronic infections or lack thereof, physical activity, for example, disturbed sleep, chemicals. Any of these, including stress, which is what our focus is today, can lead to chronic inflammation. And chronic inflammation is linked to a number of issues, everything from metabolic syndromes like diabetes to cardiovascular disease, cancer, depression, autoimmune diseases, neurodegenerative disease, sarcopenia, which Dr. Marshall discussed last time, osteoporosis, and immune functioning. So there's a lot to the science here. We obviously only have an hour, so we can't go into all the details, but it's become fairly clear that chronic stress leads to chronic inflammation, leads to chronic diseases, or at least is very well linked. And so what do? We live in this chronic state of things happening, input, and how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that? What we're going to call stress today, distress. So stress resilience, that's where the bulk of our time will be. So stress resilience is the capacity to increase awareness. I really love this word, and I'm going to focus on it quite a bit during the course of this lecture. Increase awareness of our own stress state and the stressors that lead us to that stress state. And stress resilience is a capacity to learn strategies to cope with that stress, to adapt to adversity, to return ideally to a baseline state after a stressor. And hang on to that word awareness. Now, stress resilience, we're going to focus in on mind-body medicine. That's the lecture that I've promised Dr. Marshall that I will deliver. However, there's so much to stress resilience, and that can be everything from what we just saw in one of the earlier slides, sleep, nutrition, exercise, community, psychotherapy. There's so much to helping us deal with the stresses of today. So we know that that all exists, and we will focus in on mind-body medicine. The other thing that I just want to make really clear is there are multiple levels that we can think about stress resilience. Micro, meso, and macro is what some folks write about. And Schanefeld, Dr. Schanefeld from the Mayo Clinic, has written a really wonderful pieces around physician and healthcare worker, but well-being. And this was one paper that talked about how there are individual factors, in this case, that lead to burnout, and also that can help with stress resilience. There are also factors at the work unit level, at the organization level, and at the national level, so at the meso and macro levels. We are not going to talk about all of that today. We are going to focus in on the micro level or the mind-body medicine strategies that we may be able to bring into our life. And I want to really make the point that so much of what we have to do as a society, as a community, as a group is actually at these other levels, which is really important. So knowing that, again, we'll focus in on the sliver that we can try to control or at least learn about today. So with that, now we have some definitions of stress and stress resilience. So what is this thing called mind-body medicine? What are we talking about here? It is a really hard set of words to actually define. It's a diverse group of practices. It uses the connection of the mind, the body, and behavior to promote health and well-being. And meditation is a really critical component of it. And I'm going to define meditation for you in one way, but there are literally hundreds of definitions of all of these words. This is actually a mandala drawing with chalk on a grassy knoll in England. You can see the shadow of a tree here. And I just love this picture because it didn't strike me as what it was when it first landed. And the idea is that you have all of these diverse patterns, these diverse mind-body practices, and at the core of it is this concept of a meditation. Now, often when we think of meditation, and I teach meditational practices and I learn meditational practices with patients who are going through cancer, often advanced cancer, in my practice at the Osher Center. And very often the image that a patient or a being may come into meditation is something like this. You know, someone may be in an orange robe under a tree, quiet in lotus position. And meditation can be this, and it doesn't have to be this. It can look a lot of different ways. And thousands of years of history would show us that actually meditation can look like dance. It can look like yoga. It can look like music. It can look like bow and archery. It can be a contemplative practice in a community. And so one major point I think that I would love to leave you with is this idea of meditation being in many, many forms, and you defining what resonates for you as you think about this. So here's one definition that some colleagues and I, after pulling from a number of different concepts, have come up with, and see what sticks out to you. So meditation can take many forms. It is a critical component of mind-body medicine that most generally refers to any practice that involves self-regulation of attention. So really focusing in on something potentially in a sustained fashion, potentially allowing deepening states of concentration, tranquility or insight, broadening the field of awareness, and developing altruistic tendencies, potentially. Now, it's not that every meditation leads to all of these things. That's clearly not the case. And some of meditation may sometimes lead to some of these things. And I just want to point out that word again, awareness. For me, meditation, if I had to pick one word to describe what meditation is to me, I would pick this word, awareness. With that awareness, then we can do more or different or decide how we want to act. And there are numerous types of meditation across cultures and time. One meditation that's been widely studied in the modern healthcare setting is something called mindfulness meditation. Mindfulness meditation. So often you'll hear the word mindfulness and it's used in a lot of different connotations. This one is particularly referring to a kind of meditation which aims to develop an awareness of thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations in a kind, observant, and non-judgmental manner. These are all really important words. Each one of these we could spend hours talking about. So let's talk practical. What does all that hoopla actually mean? How do you see it in your practice? So what are some of the practices that you might reflect on? So meditations can look like breath awareness, body awareness. Sometimes people call it body scans, a sound healing or a sound focus, or another focus point like a candle or a word. Mindful eating is a really beautiful type of exercise that a lot of my patients seem to enter into mindfulness with, because it turns out we eat many times, multiple times a day. And there may be something, just one bite, the first bite that we can do mindfully to bring this practice into our life. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, we'll talk about that. That's a very classic healthcare course. And we actually have it at the Osher Center at UCSF. It's an 8-week course teaching a lot of these mindfulness techniques and compassion, kindness, focused meditations. That's one very broad set of definitions of practices. Another set of practices, which I personally love, and again, a really important entry point for folks who say, look, I can't sit, I can't be quiet, this is not resonating for me, movement. I actually love movement, energy-based therapies, everything from physical activity, it might be tennis, it might be golf, it might be archery, also Qigong, Tai Chi, and yoga. You know, the concept of yoga was never yoga separate from meditation, it was yoga. And the idea was that you move your body such that you can help move your mind. And so the concepts are not separate. Relaxation techniques is another important area of mind-body practices. So progressive muscle relaxation, where you progressively, kind of in a guided way, can relax different muscle groups. Guided imagery, and if we have time, we'll do one today. And expressive practices. And this can be being out in nature. There is really interesting data coming out around the chemicals that we naturally absorb when we're out in nature. So we always have known that we feel better when we're out in nature. And now we actually understand why. There are chemicals that are released into the system from trees, from plants that we are able to absorb, breathe in, or absorb through the skin. That's super fascinating. And so nature therapy is a kind of mind-body practice. Dance, art, writing, music. These are all meditative in different ways. So let's come back to this concept of stress, chronic stress, this hunched over person, and chronic disease, many of the chronic diseases written here. And what might mind-body medicine practices, the ones that we just looked at, what might it be doing to actually help us with this process? Well, one thing it might be doing is increasing our awareness of what is our body and mind experiencing in stress? When are we in stress? What are the stressors? Can I do something about those stressors? Maybe I make some different decisions starting tomorrow. And the other really important part is a response strategy. Maybe there's not anything I can do about the stressors. Those are in my life. And maybe there's something I can do in how I respond to it. Those are really the two aspects. And again, for me, it starts with awareness, and then we make decisions around that. So poll number two, I want us as a group to think about what emotional and physical symptoms you might commonly experience with a life stressor. And so there's a number written here: anxiety, irritability, depression, panic attacks, sadness, exhaustion, headaches, high blood pressure, digestive problems, chest pain, muscle tension, aches and pains, sexual dysfunction, weakened immune system. Go ahead and put in what you experience. This is obviously anonymous, and see what, you know, in this sort of first step of awareness, what comes out of how you actually experience your stressors. And so I'm seeing these come in, and, you know, pretty much all of these different symptoms are coming through. We're almost, more than half are coming in. We'll do another maybe 3-4 seconds. Almost everyone's participated. Okay, great. I'm going to end the poll. And I'm going to share the results. And so you can see here that this is a first step in awareness of how do I actually experience stress? And so you see that actually folks really have a wide variety of how we experience stress, everything from anxiety, emotional depression, panic attacks, sadness, to physical symptoms of headaches, exhaustion, high blood pressure, digestive problems, et cetera. So really variable. And when we have this awareness in the moment, especially as we're experiencing the stressor, we may decide to do something different or deal with that stressor once we're aware of it. Okay, so I've shared the results. You can see it. And now I'm going to stop sharing and we'll go back. All right. So mindfulness, just to bring that idea back to really nail it down. So we have stimulus, we have stimuli in our life. And Michael Pollan, who's written a lot about everything from psilocybin to diets that are healthy for us, a very famous author and academic, he talks about how in life we have these stimuli, or we have a stimulus, and often over a lifetime, we develop kind of a ski slope for the skiers out there. I'm actually not a good skier, but a black diamond kind of response to a reaction, you know, same stimulus, same reaction. We get some news, we have a big reaction, and that's, you know, same year after year after year. With mindfulness, maybe what happens, the theory, is that maybe we have a moment, one small millisecond moment of awareness, and that awareness then allows us to go down, maybe not that black diamond, maybe down a green or a blue, just a slightly different response rather than reaction. And so that's the idea, that maybe that's what's happening with mindfulness. It's that split second moment, that space to actually respond in a way that perhaps is healthier. So let's talk about meditation and guided imagery for this is, I pulled this from our cancer patients website at UCSF. And the idea is that that mindfulness that we've been talking about more theoretically can be learned and taught in a number of different ways. And so here you see a group class, here you see someone doing Tai Chi outside nature. Here you see Tiger, our friend, in a waiting room, maybe doing a breathwork exercise, guided imagery. This one I love. If you have family or friends or someone that you can do some of this work with, often that's a nice way to bring it into your lifestyle because it's part of what you do as a family. And so we're going to do a short lemon guided imagery, just as an example of how our mind and body is connected. And so I want you to actually see if you can get into this. I know it's a little bit funny in a webinar versus if we were in person, but guided imagery can be, for those who aren't so familiar with meditation, can be a nice way to start to really understand that connection between mind and body. What you imagine in your mind can actually manifest in the body. And so I want you to, if you can, close your eyes if you're in a comfortable position. I'm going to leave my eyes open so that I can see what's happening in Zoom land. But I would like for you to close your eyes if you can, or look downward. And that's just to take away the senses, the other senses, so that there's a little bit less stimulus. And go ahead and take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. And do that one more time. And in your mind's eye, I want you to imagine that you're standing in your kitchen, or maybe it's in the kitchen of someone you know, but pick a kitchen. You might travel between a few. Decide on one, and in that kitchen, take a few moments to actually imagine the kitchen, the color of the countertops, the appliances, the cupboards. Notice if there are windows. Notice if there's smells or sounds, the running of a dishwasher, the hum of a refrigerator. Maybe there's a clock that's sounding. Just take a moment to really notice what's happening in that kitchen of yours. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? What are you smelling? How are you feeling being in that kitchen? And now imagine on the countertop, there's this beautiful bowl of plump, fresh, juicy lemons. And in your mind's eye, go ahead and pick up one of those lemons, hold it, feel its weight, its texture, and then set it down on a cutting board and grab your favorite knife and go ahead and cut that lemon in half. And just as you peel that lemon off each other's half, notice that pale yellow of the pulp, the whiteness of the peel. See if you've cut through a seed or two. And now carefully cut one of the halves into another half. And just notice, is there a drop of juice pearling on the surface? And if you need to, cut that quarter into an eighth, just enough so that you can pick up a little piece, a little wedge towards your mouth. Go ahead and lift that wedge up. Smell that sharp, fresh scent. And now go ahead and bite into that sour, juicy pulp. And if you dare, actually go ahead and bite again into that sour, juicy pulp. Now set that lemon down. Go ahead and slowly open your eyes or bring your eyes back to the Zoom land. And just take a breath. You're coming back from that kitchen. And I want us to do another poll to see how you experienced that. So could you sense any of the following with that guided imagery? Could you sense a smell, taste? Could you sense any salivation? Could you hear anything in that kitchen of yours? Could you touch that lemon? Could you see something in that kitchen or see the lemon? And I'm looking at the poll right now, and this is amazing. Folks are smelling it, tasting it, salivating, hearing it, touching it, seeing it. And I'll give another 1 or 2 seconds. We've got almost everyone participating. Okay, and I'm going to end the poll and share the results. So you can see here that folks were smelling, tasting, salivating, hearing, touching, seeing it. And that's what is really amazing to me about the mind-body connection. You didn't have a lemon. You weren't in a kitchen, presumably. And you could imagine all that in your mind, and you could experience that in your body, and vice versa. When you experience things in your body, you can affect the mind. And, you know, there is a lot of research. I mean, probably if any of you are from this area, Steph Curry and the Warriors and every basketball team and every sports team out there is using visualization, because there's actually really interesting neurologic MRI data that shows that visualizing that act or that experience is actually almost as effective as doing the actual activity, not in all ways, but in many ways. And so there's really interesting data around what we are conceptualizing in our mind and how that is experienced in the body. So again, hang on to that of, this is what the mind-body connection is really about. Okay, so we've talked about mind-body connection. We've talked about how it may apply for stress resilience. Now you're probably saying, okay, great, interesting concept. Thank you very much. And I'm finding it really hard to actually implement this in my life. And I understand that, because I have certainly had periods in life and continue to have periods in life where it is really hard to make the time, to have the mental space, to really be able to have this practice continue in the way that we all would probably like to. And so I want to focus in this next half really on pearls that come from folks just like you sitting in the audience, and a bit from my own experience, but really folks in the community of patients and others that I've experienced mind body practices with, of how to bring this into our life, and what works, what can help us when we have barriers to implementing mind body practices. So here's our last poll. What feels like the biggest or perceived barrier to you to start a mindfulness or mind body practice? And so go ahead and put it in. My mind is too busy. I don't have time. I fall asleep when I try to meditate. I used to be able to do more with yoga or meditation. I can't do that same thing right now because of the stresses I'm under. Information overload. I don't even know where to start. When I do meditate, it brings up too much for me. I don't know how to handle that. And you know, honestly, what am I going to get out of this? What's really the big deal about all this stuff? So thank you for everyone who's participating. We've got more than half already. I'm going to let it stay on for about another 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and we'll end the poll and we'll share the results. So you can see here that many said my mind is too busy, which is a very common thing that I myself experience and others who are in our courses experience. I don't have time. Again, very common. I fall asleep. I used to be able to do more. Information overload. Exactly. So all of these can happen. And what might be a barrier today may not be tomorrow, but there may be a different barrier for you tomorrow. So just kind of being able to roll with that is part of the art of mindfulness, actually. So let's get into some of these pearls that your peers and your community members have actually shared, and I'm just sharing it back. My mind is too busy. So I love this cartoon of a yoga class. I know I've been in the same situation. Slowly begin to reawaken the body with thoughts of unread emails, piles of dirty laundry, and the kids you have to pick up from school. And that's the reality. You know, our mind was actually meant to think. And so that is constantly what's happening. We have a river of thoughts that's going through. And so the idea of mindfulness is, at least some of mindfulness, is that awareness of actually watching these thoughts and knowing that you might get tracked down that river of thoughts, but maybe you'll learn to realize that you've gone down that river of thought or rumination and then actually bring yourself back to the riverbed and watch again those thoughts, because those thoughts aren't necessarily reality. And often those thoughts are about the past or the future. And so really kind of coming back to the present. One pearl that I want to just emphasize again is movement. Movement is really a critical piece. And so when the mind is racing or the mind is busy, try a movement practice like the ones we talked about. Dance, archery, golf, Tai Chi, yoga, that can really help to focus the energy on a focus point, from the breath to movement. And then maybe that opens up the door to other kinds of practices. This one, I love this pearl. It's something called shaking and dancing, or just dancing or movement to music, for example. I had a patient in one of our groups on mindfulness that really took to this particular practice. It's basically you shake as if you were a toddler, just kind of shaking to music. And then you stand still. After a few minutes of shaking, you stand still for, you know, a minute, and then you dance to your favorite song. And he really took to it. He had metastatic GI cancer and he just loved it. And he started doing it nightly with his two young girls. And I just love that image of him with his two daughters dancing nightly together. So many different benefits, one of which is it happened to be a mind-body practice that he could then come back to the next class and say, hey, I actually did that. But it was just a beautiful way to be in a mindful space with family in a habit or in a routine. This is my son in, I think, Bhutan. Archery, he actually doesn't do archery, but a friend of mine who's an orthopedic surgeon said to me the other day, you know, I can't meditate, I just can't do it, but I really love archery. And so she just describes this experience of archery and how she focuses in on the breath. It slows her down. She's able to be fully present. It's all about the motion. And I said, That is meditation. Meditation is nothing different. And so really actually thinking about what you already enjoy in your life and the meditational aspects of those things. Gratitude journaling and gratitude jars. So these are really wonderful ways to actually help to sometimes rewire us. I have another colleague, an oncologist, who started to do a gratitude journal daily years ago. And what she noticed is she would literally just write a few words every night. So it wasn't a massive undertaking, but, you know, two or three words and of just gratitude. And it started more generic, you know, family, friends, but then it started to get more and more specific as the days and months went on to, hey, I really appreciated that butterfly that I saw on a leaf today as I walked to work, or I really appreciated that gratitude that someone shared with me for something I did for a staff member. And what she realized is that it actually started to rewire her so that she started to notice those things that brought her gratitude during the day. And this is not to be, you know, the idea of toxic positivity. I think that's a real thing to sort of try to think positively all the time. That's not what I'm saying at all, actually. We do accept the chaos and the toughness of life. And we do also find the joys and the awe and the wonder of life and we can hold both of those. And so maybe there's some rewiring that can happen here where we start to notice a few little details of the day that actually we can write in a journal or a jar that you could do with your, you know, loved ones. This is a naming practice, and I was referring to this a little bit earlier, where a lot of what is happening in our minds is the river of thoughts, often about the past sadness, past anger, things that didn't go right, things that you could have done, would have done, should have done, or it's about future anxiety, future what's going to happen. And so the idea is not actually to push away thoughts. It is to realize that those thoughts will happen. Again, if you think back to that definition, non-judgmental, kind observation of what's happening in the mind. So not to push it away, but actually to accept that, yes, this is what's happening in my mind at the moment. And see if you can realize when you've gone into a rumination or you've gone down that river of thoughts and come back off the river of thoughts onto the riverbed. And so I love this cartoon, which is, you know, hey, past life reading, we're all into that. Future telling, we're all into that. Present moment, anyone? You know, anyone want to kind of stay right here, right now? So that this concept is a naming practice. And if you look online, you'll find some information about this particular practice. But the idea is that as you notice those thoughts in your mind, you actually name it past, future. And sometimes just the mere act of naming it can actually assist you in being mindful to the present. Okay, next major issue that folks had. I don't have time. I love this old Zen saying, which is you should sit in meditation for 20 minutes a day. Unless you're too busy, then you should sit for an hour. Some of the practices that I think work well when that is a barrier is mindful eating. I have plenty of patients who take to this exercise because, for example, you probably eat at least once a day or maybe more, and you probably take at least one bite, maybe more. And so that first bite, it doesn't need to be the whole meal. That can be a long time, but that first bite, to really think about a mindful bite where you actually notice, kind of like the lemon exercise, you actually notice, hey, what does this food feel like, look like, smell like? What is it? How am I experiencing? Who brought it to me? Who are the farmers where this was first conceived? And to really think about that interconnection, frankly, of all of us in community, and take that first bite and notice how it is in your mouth and notice what's happening, the salivation, and notice your impulse to swallow. And it can be fast, right? Less than a minute or so. And so really just doing that first bite mindfully, and then you go on to eat, and you can actually do this practice with your loved ones or whoever you might be with in that meal. And it's a way to deal with that idea that, hey, we don't have time, but we can still do this as a habit, one meal, one bite a day. Another concept is mind-body medicine snacks. which again is just taking, you know, you're in a waiting room and you want to, you have 3 minutes before you're going to go into an office. Take those 3 minutes to do a breath work or a, you know, a mindful moment. And then another key is habit chunking and really bringing this into your everyday life. So if you're folding laundry, you can actually fold laundry mindfully. You know, the idea of mindfulness is not to go be mindful for 20 minutes and then go have a chaotic life and not be mindful for the rest of the, you know, 23 hours and 40 minutes. The idea is that mindfulness becomes how one lives. And so you can actually fold your laundry mindfully and really take that first fold and really be in that moment just with the shirt that you're folding. And then remembering the tiny moments. This is actually from a patient of mine who said in one of the exercises, remembering the small things can help to feel grateful. My peripheral vision, she had eye cancer, and so her central vision was affected, but she still had peripheral vision. And so she could still see blind spots. She could still see, you know, experience depth perception. And so her sweatpants, her vision, which was maintained, she could remember those tiny moments of gratitude. I fall asleep. So this is me in Bhutan. I bring up Bhutan because it was just an amazing experience. It's a little country north of India. And I was learning some techniques that I still really resonate for me. It resonated for me. My husband here is lying flat sleeping. So I understand that. And there are multiple things that we can think about when you're falling, when you're feeling tired. So time of day, maybe choose the morning rather than later in the day. Do a shorter period rather than a long, you know, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 minute exercise. Do a 2 or 5 minute exercise just to kind of get into the rhythm. Maybe changing your position or posture from laying to seated to making sure that your back is a bit forward from the chair, things like that. Movement, which we've talked a lot about. Keeping your eyes partially open versus fully closed. Having airflow or cooler temperatures can help. Avoiding a heavy meal before. And frankly, if you're falling asleep, maybe try meditational techniques at night and actually help yourself sleep. Maybe that's actually what the body needs. I used to be able to do more. That was another one, barrier. And I love these cartoons. This one's the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz saying, this is bull bleep. And you know, this idea that, hey, one remembers the past and the feeling of, I used to be able to do all of these things, I can't do it anymore. And that can be frustrating. I have, you know, yoga teachers who come into our courses saying, hey, I used to be able to do all of this stuff and I just can't do it anymore. And one thing that we try to focus on together is, yes, we can't do some of those things. And yes, what can we do? So really focusing in on what can we do? And this cartoon is a favorite of mine, Venus de Milo, which is one of the most beautiful statues in the world, but arms are not there, looks over to probably Durga, you know, 10, I think 14 hands in this one, and says, life is so unfair, which it would feel when one looks at that other statue. And there is still just this true beauty of the Venus de Milo, if you look at it in its fullness. So what can I do? And then information overload, where do I start? And so one thing that we'll do right now as a practice is a box breath. There's diaphragmatic breathing, belly breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, which is a real deep kind of breath, what we did with the lemon guided the first couple. There's 4-7-8 breath where you take in a breath for 4, hold it for 7 and whoosh it out for 8. These are all techniques that have been studied and shown to reduce blood pressure, to help our immune systems, to bring health to us. And so I just want to take a moment to do a box breath so that you have that in your arsenal as a quick way to get into mind-body practices. And so again, if you want to just close your eyes or look downward and just kind of get into a comfortable position, I'm just going to take a breath as well. We've been chatting for 45 minutes or so. And go ahead and put your hands on your knees, on your lap. And the way that we're going to do this breath is we're going to inhale for 4, hold for 4, exhale for 4, hold for 4. And I'll do it once or twice, and then I want you to do it once or twice on your own, okay? So again, 4, 4, 4, 4, like a box. So inhale, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, hold, 2, 3, 4. Again, inhale, hold, exhale, hold. And now on your own pace, maybe faster, maybe slower, just try a couple of box breaths, inhaling, holding, exhaling, holding. And again, one more cycle, inhaling four, holding, exhaling four, holding four. So that's something called box breath, and you can practice it on your own. The next time you're in a grocery store, you can practice it while you're waiting. There's also something called belly breathing, or diaphragmatic breathing is what I like to call it. And you literally, you know, these toddlers here have little turtles on their bellies to kind of remind them to really think about pushing the diaphragm down, extending the belly, almost as if we were pregnant, for the women out there who have been, but really breathing into that belly, that, you know, lowering that diaphragm to get as much air into the lungs as possible, and then exhaling fully. And that can just be a slow diaphragmatic breath. And people will say different things when they're doing it, maybe, you know, rose when it comes in and peace when it goes out, you know, whatever two words work for you, but something to kind of keep your focus on the breath. And here's some information about our mindfulness class at the Osher Center. I won't read it all, but I'll give you a second to just either take a screenshot of this, or you can, you know, eventually some of the resources that are in my slide deck will also be available to you both before this session and then after. And you can find some of these websites there as well. We also have things like laughter yoga, restorative yoga. And these are a few select resources. There is so much on the web. And so I understand information overload. And these are a few areas, you know, if you want to take a screenshot again, these are some that I have looked at myself and are, you know, have wonderful resources in all kinds of different meditational techniques. Another barrier is it brings up too much for me. And this is real. And there is something called meditation related adverse effects, because again, that first step is awareness. And so that can bring up things for folks that we may not be yet equipped to deal with. And so there are MRAEs, they're called, such as anxiety, re-experiencing trauma, emotional sensitivity. And that's really important to note. And if that is happening for you when you are starting to try some of these practices, I want you to talk to someone in the healthcare field to help you figure out what might be the right resources to help navigate that. Now, there was one study that's listed down here by Goldberg that actually looked at MRAEs in a group of meditators. Once folks were meditating, actually, what was interesting is that the participants that experienced these adverse effects, even though they experienced these adverse effects, they were actually equally glad to have participated in those practices as those not reporting the adverse effects. And the hypothesis here was that, yes, there was awareness. And as folks learned the practices over time, those folks also learned strategies to help with that awareness and ultimately deepen their health. So these risks may be able to be reduced by trauma-informed care and really working with qualified experts who can help you through that. This is real, and I do take this very seriously. And so please do reach out to folks who can help you with that if that's the case. And then I really like this cartoon too, which is really about mindfully listening to oneself and to another, because sometimes when we have a reaction that's greater than what we might think we should be reacting as, or what you experience a reaction from someone else and you say, wow, why did they just react that way? There may be some past trauma or something else they're carrying in to that conversation. And so this little heart here is carrying in past trauma and then bad news, pandemic, stress, something else up here. And then there's a minor inconvenience, maybe a minor conversation that in most cases wouldn't lead to some reaction. But boy, in this case, it did, because the heart is carrying in a lot more than meets the eye. And so the brain is telling the heart, I think you're overreacting. And it's because there's a lot to this. And so the awareness is that first step to understand what's behind some of those reactions. And then what am I going to get out of this? So for the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to go over by about a few minutes into our Q&A. I want to talk about what are we getting out of these? And so we're going to go a little more science-y again from the pearls that our community has given us. There are many types of philosophical discussions, and one philosophical framework is this, that there are three kinds of wisdoms that can come from meditational practices: attentional, constructive, and deconstructive. I find this fascinating. If you're not a philosopher or you don't want to talk existential stuff, you can do your box breathing for a minute. Attentional wisdoms may be things like being able to develop focus, awareness, quieting the ruminating mind, being able to be more present in conversation with your family, with your friends, concentration at work. So those are attentional wisdoms that you may get out of meditational practices. Constructive wisdoms are things like what's happening interpersonally, loving kindness, compassion, morality, gratitude, pro-social, meaning developing interpersonal relationships. Those may come out of certain types of meditations or certain experiences with meditations. And the third bucket of wisdoms that may come out at a more philosophical level is deconstructive. So this is kind of a deeper wisdom around interconnectedness, impermanence, which means, hey, we are on this planet for some amount of time, and then many folks have many beliefs of what happens after that, and what that could look like for you: insight, reflection, inquiry, why me, why now, why this. And so these are kind of the three philosophical buckets that can come out of meditational experience. And then coming down to the physical and emotionals, you know, so psychosocial symptoms that we might be benefiting from. These are some key papers in cancer, and Linda Carlson has done just an amazing amount of work in this space. So I just picked out a couple of articles from her and the national guidelines from the Comprehensive Cancer Network. And these guidelines, based on some of the work from Linda Carlson and many others, now are national guidelines based on the best of our evidence, systematic reviews, randomized control trials, meta-analyses that show that MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, meditation, yoga, and some of these other things actually impact, scientifically proven with data, things like pain, fatigue, sleep disorders, distress, anxiety, depression, cognitive dysfunction, night sweats, sexual dysfunction, nausea, vomiting. So this is what all of us as oncologists, for example, look to as the best data showing us the best resources for our patients. And so there is a lot of data now to support mind-body practices in many chronic diseases. This is one of my favorite randomized control trials. I'm not going to read this to you, but if anyone wants to, again, take a screenshot, it's a trial that actually looked at MBSR, mindfulness-based stress, actually it was cancer recovery, which is based on mindfulness-based stress reduction. So MBCR versus supportive expressive group therapy, which was more of a support group with some other interventions, and about the same amount of time and interaction with facilitators. And what was figured out in this research was that actually there is benefit with both, and there is even additional benefits with MBCR compared to the supportive groups that we do. So both are good, and there may be other things that we are learning when we have these mindfulness-based learnings or teachings. And these are longer, you know, 8 to 12 week kind of courses. And this is another study that looked at anxiety and actually looking at Lexapro versus MBSR, and showing that actually at baseline and then many weeks out, the impact was the same along this graph here for MBSR, again, mindfulness-based stress reduction versus taking medication. And so this really showed that we may be able to, we may have to take medication and we may be able to get some of the benefit from MBSR. I'm going to skip that for a second. And then this study is blood pressure. And there's a lot of cardio benefit with many of these practices. And this is a practical, this was a systematic review meta-analysis, and it started to show, hey, even with 15 minutes a day, we actually started to see benefit in terms of blood pressure. And this kind of lists out some of the different techniques and the amount of minutes. And interestingly, actually, I just heard an abstract talking about 10 minutes a day for about 8 weeks, showing changes in our brain function and the anatomy and functionality of our brain. So we don't know what the exact lowest dose is that benefits us, but we do have some emerging evidence that even small doses help. And this is some of the brain data that shows both structural anatomy changes as well as functional changes in areas like the amygdala, which is generally about that fight or flight response. Being able to reduce that natural tendency to fight or flight or sympathetics that we were talking about earlier, so that we can be in a healthier balance. And then another really interesting area of research right now is around telomeres. Telomeres are the caps of our chromosomes. And as we age, those caps kind of unravel. And so there's some really interesting data around retreat studies in this case, showing that there are actually increases in telomerase activity, which is the enzyme that keeps those caps in place, in as little as 1 week of a retreat, and increases in telomere length in as little as 3 weeks. So there's a lot of interesting data around telomeres, inflammation, immunity, brain function, et cetera, that show us the benefit of mindfulness meditation. And this is kind of a catch-all because there are literally hundreds, probably thousands of studies at this point in this space. And so we can see improvements in all of these: immune functioning, overall well-being, memory, awareness. You can read the list here. And decreases in things like rumination, anxiety, depression, stress, burnout, reactivity. And so some of the key concepts that I'd love for you to hold on to are, number one, awareness, which to me is the start of meditational experiences, and then a strategy around responses to that. If you're interested in learning more about those things, some of the practices that I've mentioned and some of the resources with MBSR, for example, are good places to start. There are many, many types of practices and wisdom, so consider what resonates for you, and what resonates for you one day may not the next day, so see if you can be flexible with that. Starting small and consistent with mind-body snacks is a really good way to go because it is hard sometimes to find the time, energy to get past those barriers. And then see if one can let it become part of how we live life. And this is a practice because even the most experienced of meditators find it hard to meditate often and or if they're going through a life stressor. So know that, you know, bring that non-judgmental, kind self. And I always like to come to an end with this slide, which is what you practice grows stronger. So just like we practice our bicep curls, like Dr. Marshall taught us some of those exercises last time, just as we practice certain muscle groups and those get stronger, same thing with mind-body practices. If we practice this awareness and responsiveness versus reactivity, that can grow stronger. And it's when we need it, it's in our toolbox so that you practice it and then apply it when you really need it in life. I'd love for you to spend just a minute making your own meditation prescription today. And so pick, and if you can, write it down. So pick a type of practice, and we've talked about a bunch of these. We haven't talked about all of these, but a handful. And see if one of them resonates for you and write it down. And then write down some details of how long. When would you do it? How often? What time of day would you do it? Where would you do it? In a room, out in nature, in an office, at your lunch, after your lunch, and then who might you do it with and other tips that might be helpful to you. See if there are resources that are required and acknowledge for yourself if there's a barrier for you to actually start that routine. So just take 30 seconds or so to take this in and see if you can give yourself a mind-body prescription. And in the interest of time, I'm going to move forward, but you can take a screenshot of this and keep kind of working through your mind-body medicine prescription for yourself. Good health adds life to years. I really liked this quote. Often we think of adding years to our life, but really adding life to our years. And this is that Tiger's Nest, beautiful monastery perching off of in the Himalayas in Bhutan. So I want to thank a team, which is just amazing. And I learn as much every day still today as I did many years ago. And so none of what you just saw happens in a vacuum. And so I really owe this whole group here so much in terms of my own learnings.
Thank you, Kavita, for that beautiful talk. That was just splendid. Okay. And I really liked the mind body medicine snacks. I love that because we can, the thing like in exercise, you can have, you know, 5 minutes of exercise is better than none. 5 minutes of meditation or deep breathing when you don't have a lot of time, just a little bit of that to downregulate our stress response. The fact that that can be so beneficial is really great news for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm glad that you bring that up because I think in today's, in our world today, those ways to enter into spaces are so important. And we have to be creative sometimes. So yeah, I agree. Exercise snacks, mind body medicine snacks. You've got your prescription.
So I'm going to go through some of the questions that these, we're having some really good questions come up. One of them was about, is there any research that's been done on reversing years of chronic stress? So say a person is a multi-person caregiver, has had years of chronic stress. How, you know, is there data that some of these practices could help that person, even though they've had stress for over a long period of time?
Yeah, great question and really important question. So of course, every body is different. We only know what we know from experience and from research data. So a lot of the research has been done in chronic illness, chronic inflammation, chronic stressors, and chronic diseases that we know are related to chronic inflammation. So the short answer to that question is yes, there is research that shows that even with chronic stress, years and years of stress, that these type of practices can help us increase the health of our years. And you see that in some of the data that we showed around symptoms of anxiety, depression that may have been longstanding related to chronic disease or chronic stress, and those can be reduced over time. Now, of course, sometimes chronic stress leads to things that may be irreversible, and that's just the reality of what happens to the body. But the whole idea of mind-body medicine is that, yes, chronic stress, at least some part of it may be reversible so that we can help, you know, like the telomere data, for example, we can actually help keep them in place versus having them continue to unwind over time. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that answers the question. What recommendations do you have for someone who started a mindfulness practice or meditation practice and then has fallen off? How do you help people with consistency and getting back into the practice?
Mm-hmm. Another really important point and question. So consistency is a really critical piece of mind-body practices. And so trying to do something once a week, sometimes people can make that work, but generally that's not going to be as sustainable as something that you can do more consistently. And so if you can find a two-minute practice that you can do more consistently, that's usually going to be a better way for you to get into the practice and actually maintain it. A lot of the details that we talked about in terms of short practices, bringing it into your routine, i.e. with your laundry or with your kids with mindful eating, or you tend to go on a nature walk anyway. So doing a mindful walk where you really notice what's around you, the leaf, and you actually take a moment to ponder that leaf, bringing it into everyday life in a way that you know is sustainable for your life is going to be key. And the mind-body medicine snacks, I know we keep kind of coming back to it, but that's been a really important piece, I think, for a lot of my patients, which is how can you think of just those moments where you're in a grocery store line and you're waiting for something and you might be getting stressed about it, or you could decide to do a box breath or a deep abdominal breath. And that is the practice. And so literally, you know, 2 minutes or 1 minute. The other piece is mornings. Often mornings are a good time to get in a meditation, because as the day goes on, most of us will realize that this mind starts to go and then it's hard to come back to it. So sometimes mornings, if that works for you and your schedule, that's a good time to get a practice in, sort of the first thing that you do. And then habit chunking is another important thing. You know, if you're brushing your teeth, which you should do every day, after you brush your teeth, you go directly into a meditation. If you can chunk habits, they're more likely to stay. So that's another thing to think about, sort of habit chunking. Those are a few things. And then the gratitude journal is a really nice, often can be a feasible thing because it's short, you know, one word literally that you could write. But that could be another attainable or feasible thing for folks. Often it's a mental barrier, right? Of gosh, I just don't have so much time, or you remember doing a 20 minute or an hour long yoga every day and you don't have time for that, mm-hmm. or you don't have energy for that. And so being able to understand your barriers and where your present body is able to do, and then adapting to where your present body and mind are. So that adaptation is important too.
So one of the I don't know if it was a barrier, but one of the things you talked about was that it's too overwhelming for someone, and these adverse events sometimes that happen with meditation. Can you speak about complex PTSD and, you know, a patient that maybe has a history of trauma, mm-hmm. and physical symptoms from trauma, and maybe the somatic practices that could potentially help that person?
Yeah, I'll start, and you should add in other thoughts too. There is a lot to trauma-informed care, and I'm definitely not an expert in that particular area. I have techniques that we bring into our meditational practices when we teach them, but really for someone who's been through trauma, PTSD, you know, a diagnosis, I recommend that they see a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist or someone who's really trained in various techniques, cognitive behavioral techniques, other techniques that they can really help to allow that awareness, and then also allow the response strategies, because that is much more intense, or it can be much more intense. So I usually will say, if that's coming up for you, please see a healthcare professional. Usually I'll, you know, psycho-oncology or psychiatry, counseling, someone who's trained in some of these techniques for trauma-informed care.
Yeah, and I would say that somatic therapies like yoga or chanting, or there might be other forms of therapy that can help with trauma and releasing trauma from the body. Mm-hmm. But I think it's always good to be under the care of a professional, you know, a trauma-informed therapist, because that can help people in integrating and processing these mm-hmm. types of mind-body practices. That's yes. a really good question.
Yeah, so and there's and that's an excellent point, which is movement practices, which we spent some time on, can be a really critical piece of that trauma-informed care. And actually, I'm thinking about a patient of mine who, a different patient who really took to the shaking and dancing, because that was just a way to really release, you know, through the body, what was being carried, in the, you know, mind, body, soul. And so, yes, I think yes and yes. So yes, see professional folks who can really help you, navigate that. And yes, there may be techniques, particularly around movement, that may be really healthy for folks who are going through PTSD or other traumatic re-experiencing.
So there's two questions on blood pressure and stress. And one is, how do I know my high blood pressure is due to stress? So that's one question. And then in the other question, it talks about how mind-body medicine might lower blood pressure. Is it just lowering of the sympathetic response? Does it change circulation capacity? Maybe you could speak to that and cardiovascular effects of lowering stress with heart rate variability.
Yeah, perfect. That's great. So high blood pressure can be due to a lot of different reasons. And so stress is one thing that can lead to cardiac issues like high blood pressure. And of course, there can be a lot of other reasons that can lead to, that can lead to high blood pressure. And so if there's a question of why am I having high blood pressure, I want you to see your doc and kind of decipher through that. You probably have some sense of, I have some genetic history, I have family history, I'm not eating well, I'm not exercising, and I'm living a very stressful life. So it could be one or many of those factors. Stress is definitely been linked in that, in that one slide that I showed, stress leading to chronic inflammation, leading to cardiovascular disease is a really relatively well understood pathway. And so how is that undone in terms of why are those blood pressure studies showing that, hey, when I meditate for 15 minutes, I'm actually over time able to bring my blood pressure down. We understand a bit of why that might be happening. We don't understand all of it. And so, yes, as Dr. Marshall was just saying, we think that it may be from that parasympathetic, sympathetic balance in terms of being able to not go into this sympathetic overdrive and actually be able to balance it so that you're in a less reactive state. There are inflammatory, chemicals, molecules that are running through our bodies. And we know that when we're in a stress state, those inflammatory cells can lead to atherosclerosis and other things. And so when we are unstressing, when we are de-stressing with mind-body practices, we can help to undo some of that inflammation. And that may be leading to a reduction in blood pressure. So there's multiple hypotheses of what might be happening, but at least likely related to autonomic nervous system and inflammation. And then heart rate variability, actually, I would love, Dr. Marshall, for you to comment on this, because I know this is an area that you think a lot about too. So actually, yeah, maybe I'll ping it to you, because I know there's a lot of good data around mindfulness and heart rate variability actually leading to better variability. But yeah, curious what your thoughts are on that too.
So heart rate variability is the differences beat to beat of how our heart, how consistent our heart is beating at the same pace. And so if it's more variable, that means that the person has a lower sympathetic tone. So lower, the sympathetic nervous system is lowered and the parasympathetic, the rest and digest system is higher. So it's kind of a measure of your stress response. And if your heart rate variability is low, it's not good, because that means your sympathetic system is high, and it's associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events. So the things that can change heart rate variability are meditation practices, things that lower your stress response, exercise, especially aerobic cardiac exercise. But it's just another measure. So people that do wearables like the Oura Ring or the Whoop strap, or I don't know if the Fitbit measures it, but there's certain wearables that people use that can tell you what your heart rate variability is. And people note that over time, if they're doing these stress reduction practices or if they're exercising, which is also a stress reduction practice, then their heart rate variability will go up, and that is healthier for their cardiovascular system and your heart.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I know in the mindfulness literature, there is a lot around heart rate variability and importantly with exercise. And so, yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of great data around the cardiac benefits. I showed you one slide around blood pressure, but there's a lot, everything from, our left ventricle, how much it hypertrophies, to blood pressure, to heart rate. And actually, there's some really interesting data around some of the oldest data is around yogis, and you know, folks, researchers would place all these you know, brain and heart function devices on yogis, and the yogis would be able to bring their heart rate down to levels that were relatively unheard of, you know, in the 30s and 40s. And so, yeah, there's some really interesting data on cardiac, in fact.
So one question is about your advice for addressing health-related anxiety from a cancer survivor through a mind-body practice.
Health-related anxiety. So how to approach anxiety with some of these practices. Yeah.
Right.
So the one slide that I showed quickly around the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which is a nationwide network that brings together guidelines for what kind of chemo to give, what kind of radiation to give, what dose to give, and also mind-body practices, which ones may help which symptoms based on the data that we have today. And again, meta-analyses, systematic reviews, randomized control trials. And so there's one of those lines is actually anxiety and depression, that there is really strong data showing that MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, meditation, and yoga can actually help with anxiety. And that's for cancer in particular. One of the other studies I showed quickly was for anxiety more generally, where some of the medications, the impact was the same as mind-body practices. And so there may be an ability to use mind-body practices, maybe with or instead of, you know, depending on the situation, medication. And so anxiety in particular has been shown to be a really important symptom that mind-body practices can help with.
So the next question is about how do you meditate if you're in an environment where it's really noisy, mm-hmm. especially if you're a beginner and you're, you know, it's very distracting and unavoidable. How would you suggest someone do a meditative practice or some type of mind-body medicine practice?
Yeah, great question. There are a couple of things that I'm thinking about. One is if there's a choice and if the noisiness is just not working for you, see if you may want to try something else. You know, maybe that's just not going to work for you, at least for starters. So that's kind of the simpler answer.
Or go to your car.
Yeah, or go to your car. Well, yeah, so you can find a quieter spot, go to your car or earplugs, you know, things like that. Now, if you can't, you know, if you just have a situation where you just have a lot going on, one thing is if you do a guided imagery, so you know, you're actually listening to something, or maybe you're doing it with the people that you're with and you're all doing it together, like a mindful eating exercise. So guided imagery, you know, you're putting something on and you're doing it in a guided way, maybe with, you know, earphones in. That might be able to be one way to be even in a noisy spot, but kind of have your own experience. If you're in a spot where there's just a lot of action, maybe bringing those people in, like I said, mindful eating, is one way that I've found folks who have a really active household or situation, they can do a mindful experience for that first bite and actually bring it into the family unit, whatever that looks like for you, and experience a mindfulness practice that way. The other thing that I'll just mention is one of the practices that I learned early on when I was traveling through India, I sat with this, you know, yogi teaching me, and there was this music playing in the background, and it was, as you're saying, the person who wrote the question, really distracting. And I just could not, you know, I was really trying to push that music out of my head, and I could not do it. You know, it just kept distracting me, and I was pushing and pushing and pushing. And the yogi said to me, "Don't push it, accept it. You know, maybe it's trying to tell you something, let it come in." And so I stopped pushing that thought or that impulse or that, you know, stimulus, and I allowed it to come in. And then, you know, sort of got into the rhythm of focusing on my breath and focusing on the meditation, the guidance. And as I did that, I realized that the music was no longer in my brain. I sort of had stopped pushing, allowed it in, and then I wasn't noticing it at some point. And after the meditation was done, you know, some whatever, 45 minutes later, I realized, I asked the yogi, you know, what happened to the music? Because actually it was still playing. And I thought, you know, had they stopped playing the music for some time? And he said to me, actually, the music was playing the whole time. You probably just, you know, stop hearing it. And so anyway, I say that because this idea of pushing can be very natural and very hard, because it actually makes it hard to get into a meditative space. So accepting that river of impulse or that thought, and then kind of allowing it to do what it's going to do, maybe is another way to approach. But anyway, so those are a few ways to approach.
Yeah, those are really good. This is true Northern California question.
Love it.
Like mindful eating, can mindful drinking be a form of meditation? For instance, I love wine. This is the person writing the question. I focus on the taste, color, and other unique features. I find it relaxing and stress relieving. So can you comment on mindful drinking?
That's such a funny and fun question. I love that. Yes. I mean, mindfulness, like I said, can be, and ideally, you know, it's sort of what we imagine is we live life mindfully. Again, like I said, you know, it's not about going to be mindful for 5 minutes and then going to live unmindfully for the rest of the day. And so mindful drinking, yeah, sure. I mean, that makes sense to me, right? Because you're really in the moment, you're enjoying it, you're present, you're noticing, you're using all of your different senses. So in all of those ways, that is a meditation of sorts. And so, yes, I agree that can be. Separate from that, obviously, you know, alcohol has a lot of other things. And Dr. Marshall, you may have talked a little bit about it last time. I don't know. I can't remember. But there are other things that we think about as oncologists in terms of alcohol and impact and what some of the guidelines say today. So separate from that, but yes, mindful drinking, totally. I hear that.
Could you talk about combining medication with meditation, like Lexapro or antidepressants with meditation? Is there any danger in that?
So I never say like a total yes or no, because I always want you to go to your healthcare professional team and make sure that any implications for your health in particular are understood. But generally, yes, you know, for sure. Many folks are on both medications for whatever it might be, anxiety or depression or even blood pressure, and they may partake in mindfulness or meditations. Now, you may watch out for how that starts to impact your body. So for example, very practically, blood pressure medicine. I have had folks who have actually needed to reduce their blood pressure medicine because they were able to start lowering their blood pressure with some of their meditational practices. And then they didn't need as much blood pressure medication. So you may need to be mindful of what's happening for your mind and body. And yes, those are usually, one can do these practices almost always in a very healthy way. You have to just find what that looks like for you.
We really appreciate your attention and your interest in our program. Thank you very much, and good night. Again, thank you for sharing your night with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nice to see.
And thank you, Kavita. Thank you so much for that great talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.